This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 18 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I've been really fortunate to have recruited and worked with some brilliant writers at NumberFire over the near 4 years that I've been employed by the site. We've got Brandon Gadula and Jim Sonnes, who are my go-to dudes when it comes to analysis of really any sport. I couldn't do my job without Jim and Brandon. They're my dudes. Chris Raybon, who's now at 4for4, he started writing at NumberFire. That's how he started writing about fantasy football. Graham Barfield, a data-driven analyst who's now at fantasyguru.com, he wrote for us at NumberFire. Scott Barrett, who's at Pro Football Focus. Brian Mears, who's at Fantasy Labs. Jeff Miller, who's at Dynasty League Football. And a ton of other guys that are still at NumberFire, like Russ Peddle, who's our main NBA guy. Austin Cass, who's at NumberFire now and actually started writing for me when Late Round QB was a content site. Sam House, who is a NumberFire writer and is now employed by NumberFire as our projections czar. Joe Redman, John Stolness, Jason Shandle. I mean, the list goes on, and I know that I'm missing plenty of people. To be able to work alongside those guys and so many others has been, honestly, one of the biggest joys I've gotten from doing this whole editor-in-chief slash fantasy football and football analyst thing at NumberFire. I don't mean to sound sappy, but it makes me proud when I see some of these guys do big things. But given the nature of my job, I've had to give feedback to each and every one of those guys at some point in time. Even though some of the feedback may have felt harsh to them when they first heard it, and look, I'm not trying to be a jerk, I'm just giving them some constructive criticism. And the fact was, and this is what I tell people all the time who are writing at NumberFire, who have written for NumberFire, we have the same goal. That goal is great content. I wanted these guys to push the envelope with unique content because that's one of the biggest and most important ways to differentiate yourself in a somewhat saturated fantasy football industry. You have to write something that's unique all while believing in that something unique. You can't just write something different because it's different. You can't just say, I'm going to write about a strategy where you pick tight ends in the first 7 rounds of your draft because that's not logical. You have to believe in what you're actually writing. You have to back it up with data and believe in it. And when you get that perfect storm, when you can combine something you believe in while it being something the world hasn't seen before, that's when you get a hit. That's when people start falling in love with what you're doing. Look across the fantasy football industry. What do people love? What do they consume? What content are people digging? What comes to mind? Evan Silva's matchup column. No one does anything like that because no one can do anything like that. Rich Rebar's worksheet. Rich is a wizard with data. No one can duplicate or compete with what Rich does every week with his worksheets. Matt Harmon's reception perception, another great example. All three of those things are unique in that they're detailed and specific and have a purpose. They're not just fantasy football rankings. They're not just a sleeper article on a player that other people are writing about. This idea is honestly why I have a job where I heavily analyze fantasy football and football. Because back in 2011 and 2012, when everyone was drafting their quarterbacks early, I knew that was a terrible idea. Mathematically and data-wise, I knew that was not smart. And I was passionate about it. So my ebook, The Late Round Quarterback, was born. An idea that can change the way a large group of people think about anything is awesome. Even if it's fantasy football, it's still awesome. And today's guest was once able to articulate one of those special ideas, changing the way so many of us approach the stupid game we love to spend hours analyzing. Sean Siegel is the brainiac behind the zero RB strategy. He's the one who started the movement, explaining that it's wide receivers, not running backs, that you want to select early and often in your fantasy football drafts. What I love about Sean's analysis is that it's littered with modesty. He knows that humans are wrong all the time with predictions, and that's really where this zero RB strategy sort of stems from. That you're going to be wrong, and so am I, so let's play into that variance a bit rather than thinking that we have all the answers going into a fantasy football season. I wanted to pick Sean's brain a bit and not just talk about the strategy itself, but how he, the person who started this revolution, approaches his fantasy drafts. Because, after all, I want actionable advice for all of you to become better at playing fantasy football. Here's what Sean had to say. So Sean, there are so many layers to every fantasy football strategy, and I know that sitting as a guest on a show how frustrating it can be when the host asks you to explain your strategy in just 4 or 5 sentences. But Sean, what's the best and easiest way to look and think about the zero RB strategy? What is it all about?
The original article was zero running back, anti-fragility, and the myth of value-based drafting. And I think those elements, along with sort of this idea of the race to fill the flex, sort of provides a basic roadmap. Essentially, we're avoiding running backs in the high leverage rounds because they're the most difficult to project. And you can look at this from a variety of perspectives, whether it's injury rates in terms of points implied by ADP, or in terms of what running back points in any particular year. Tell us about running back points in the following year. I've written about this quite a bit, but I think Josh Hermesmeyer has actually written a couple of spectacular pieces that look at injury rates in the high leverage rounds. And then, you know, he updated it after 2016 because obviously, you know, there's a shift in thinking there just across the community. And he still found that, you know, we have a huge difference in our prediction errors in the early rounds for running backs versus wide receivers. So at the same time, this wide receiver position is a ready source of points, both really early and then in the rounds where you'd be looking to fill your flex. So zero running back is looking to load up on wide receiver firepower with anywhere from, say, 4 to 7 receivers, perhaps even adding, you know, 1 or 2 of the elite tight ends, and then moving to running back after that. I think that the best argument for it, or looking at it from a anti-fragility perspective, is that as the season goes along, a zero running back lineup is going to get better. It's going to break. It's going to benefit from breakouts. It's going to benefit from injuries, while traditional lineups tend to get worse because they're not set up in that way to benefit when really positive things happen for the team. So basically, zero running back is an approach that gives you a structural advantage from the perspective of drafting and team composition while allowing you to benefit from the chaos of the season.
Yeah, you know, I just got done finishing a podcast on the supply and demand aspect of fantasy football. And, you know, I think it would just be fitting to at least ask this question, that with the zero RB strategy, given the nature of the strategy, this works better in wide receiver heavy leagues. Is that correct?
I definitely think so. And it works especially well in leagues that are 2 running back, 3 wide receiver and a flex, or, you know, some close variant of that. One of the keys that, you know, really helps is that owners have a much greater need to score well at running back 1 than, say, wide receiver 3 or flex. And because of that, you know, those positions can be a huge source of points for zero running back teams. But obviously, you know, it's much, much more so in wide receiver heavy formats.
Yeah. So then in formats where, say, you're starting 2 running backs, 2 wide receivers and a flex, and maybe it's more of a, it's a standard league and you're not getting points for a reception, are you approaching that draft still in, from a zero RB perspective, or are you changing things up a bit?
In standard leagues, especially ones with shallow starting lineups, the point scoring potential of wide receivers doesn't really make them must owns for me, and there's just not much scarcity. So if I'm in a league like that, I actually play it the other way and try to select some of my favorite running backs, you know, players I don't otherwise get to own.
So you already talked about anti-fragility a bit. In the original Zero RB article that you wrote about the resilience of a running back heavy lineup. We know that running backs will get hurt at a higher rate than other positions, and we know that we're going to be wrong with our projections for really any position, but running backs in particular in this case. So why not just increase our probability of hitting on a running back by drafting a lot of them? And that's what the resilience part kind of comes from. But we also know that in almost any league format, after the season concludes, elite running backs truly are the ones that are giving you the biggest edge in fantasy football. You know, aside from 2015, that's really been the case, where you have players like David Johnson and Le'Veon Bell who are giving you that significant edge week to week. The issue seems to be that actually obtaining that running back is the difficult part, but it does feel like there is a big three that we should all feel pretty confident in, with David Johnson, Le'Veon Bell, and Ezekiel Elliott. It's sort of like the LaDainian Tomlinson days back in the early 2000s. So let me ask you this. In a standard league, or even a typical 3 wide receiver flex PPR league, are you then passing on David Johnson, Le'Veon Bell, or Ezekiel Elliott because of the confidence that, you know, I sort of feel, I know a lot of others feel, of those backs compared to what we've felt in the past?
There's so much going on there, and it really goes back into this idea of fantasy football being complicated and being interesting. I guess I would dispute that the running backs have been quite that powerful. If you simply look at the year-end results, you know, you can make an argument in favor of some of the top-scoring quarterbacks in any given year, and we obviously know from all of your great work that that's not the right way to look at it. You know, the last decade, for the last 10 years, a wide receiver has outscored the top running back. And in one of the years they didn't, you know, Calvin Johnson was just outscored by a point when Adrian Peterson had his historic season. You know, during that time period, wide receivers have half of the top 50 seasons. They have a big edge in top 100 seasons. And because of the way ADP inefficiencies have allowed you to stack wide receivers in leagues that, you know, are essentially are pretty close to being four wide receiver formats, you know, wide receivers have consistently delivered, you know, these huge results. I think it's also the case that it's becoming less clear that you need to take the elite running backs early in order to have a shot at those big seasons. Yeah. So I like to look at the fantasy regular season because I think your roster should be designed to get you into the tournament. And because, you know, once we reach week 14, zero running back teams are loaded up with reinforcements anyway. And this can also help give us a feel for how the ordering events can give us a strong impact on the way that narratives emerge. So, for example, last season, you know, David Johnson, Le'Veon Bell, Melvin Gordon, they all got hurt within a handful of weeks of each other. Mm-hmm. If those injuries happen in a different order, then I think, you know, the actual state of things wouldn't have changed, but the narrative, the takeaway from 2016, I think, becomes very different then. You know, so if we look at the weeks 1 through 13 for the last two seasons, we got six different running backs with 20-plus points, and half of them were picked at pick 50 or later. We've got 24 running backs who averaged 15-plus points, and 11 of them were drafted pick 50 or later. And I think that these trends are going to continue. Ben Gretsch has written a couple of excellent articles for RotoViz looking at some of the structural elements of this. And even if you end up not agreeing with his work, I think that you should check that out because there's so much good information there. And I think those trends are continuing. So to get back to your question, it all goes back to what we can predict. And even last season, you know, you look at the first wide receiver is Antonio Brown. The first running back off the board is Todd Gurley. So, you know, you could miss out on David Johnson by taking Brown or Odell Beckham or Jones, but you could also miss out by taking Gurley. And, you know, that would be much more catastrophic. But again, I think that you have to look at what's actually going on or, you know, not be political or dogmatic in your approach. So if you've got running backs who, based on their workload, you know, it really looks like they're going to have points. And you look at the expected points based on rushing and receiving for those top couple guys, I would argue that Elliott has work to do from a receiving perspective to get up to where he has the same number of expected points that would put him in this category where, I mean, those top two guys are just, you know, blowing the world apart with the points. And so if you have access to those players, you know, I think that you either have to take them or you have to have really good reasons based on how the rest of your board falls to not take them.
Yeah, I think the key takeaway there that I think is brilliant is thinking about fantasy football in a way of things that don't happen rather than the things that do happen. And that's sort of what I talk about a lot with the late round quarterback and what the basis of that is that it's opportunity cost. And it's the way of, you know, when you're drafting a quarterback early, it's not about what you're getting out of that quarterback. It's about what you're not getting out of that running back or wide receiver that you didn't draft in that spot. And to your point, these injuries that are happening, which we know injuries happen more frequently at the running back position, these injuries that are happening, if they were to happen in week 3 or 4 rather than week 14 or 15, then we could be looking at this entire running back landscape completely differently than we are right now because of the difference that 2016 had compared to 2015. And maybe in 2015, if some of those injuries happened later in the season, we would be thinking of it differently as well. So I think that, and then also to your point with the Todd Gurley and David Johnson example, where some folks were taking Todd Gurley over David Johnson, and it's almost like this alternate universe where, like, I think it's very, very beneficial for people to start thinking about the fact that, number one, we're not going to get everything correct. And that's what zero RB and the foundation of it is kind of about, is that everything has variance and we as humans can't project things very well. And that is especially true at the running back position. So, Sean, let me ask you then, given all this, what are some of the common misconceptions with zero RB? Because I'm sure there are tons and tons of people out there, even analysts, who have just kind of read the article, maybe didn't even read the article. They just read the headline and see that it's about zero RB. And then they start either ranting against it or they support it. But what are they kind of getting wrong when they're talking about it?
One thing that's always unfortunate is that once something becomes politicized, then I think the discussion of the ideas gets lost in a way that's really unfortunate. But, you know, looking at the biggest misconception, I would simply say that it's probably this idea that zero running back, or the people who were in favor of it, are in favor of this really rigid approach and think everyone should do it in every draft. That's really the exact opposite of the way I would hope people would approach this, and, you know, just fantasy sports in general. I think the reason the article originally struck a chord was because of the freedom that it encouraged. You know, it says you don't have to select running backs early. You don't have to draft a balanced lineup. There are other ways to approach a draft that has, you know, they have these strong methodologies behind them that are being used successfully in high stakes formats, and that in many cases even give you a structural advantage on your opponents. But the idea that zero running back is the only way, or that a zero running back owner is going to win every league, I mean, that's equally silly. You know, there was this strange mini controversy last year because it was pointed out that, you know, my 2013 primetime team that won, you know, had Jamaal Charles. And, I can understand, you know, why that would pop out to people as being odd. But, you know, most of the teams that year were zero running back teams. But if I'm in a situation where I think an early running back has league winning potential, then, you know, I will get some exposure to that. Mm-hmm. And you look at something like, I have a lot of people, just a very large number of extremely smart owners and writers have asked about this idea of just taking one running back early, you know, whomever you really like at that particular draft spot, and then say, you know, hammering with six wide receivers or something after that. And you can certainly see how there are going to be plenty of benefits to that. You know, you're going to get some of that exposure to this extreme upside potential with a particular running back, while also, you know, building in a lot of running back points. I mean, the thing that I encourage people not to do is hammer running back in a way that what you're really buying are a lot of future running back injured games, and you're costing yourself a bunch of wide receiver points. But again, I think the biggest takeaway, or the most important sort of parallel note to zero running back, is just to make sure that when you're putting together your board, you emphasize the structural elements of the particular game that you're playing. Because every game has slightly different exploitable elements that require an understanding of the interaction between player point distributions, injuries, breakouts, waivers, scoring settings, you know, starting lineup requirements. One board will not work the same way for all of those things. And, you know, going back to the beginning, this idea of value-based drafting, you know, that won't answer the questions that you have to answer in order to set up an approach for the different leagues.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a key thing too. You and I both very, very, very much so agree about VBD and the flaws of VBD. And I think that at the end, that's kind of what spawned both of the strategies that we push forward. You know, the late round quarterback is that it ignores market value, it ignores opportunity cost. And with what you're saying is that it most certainly ignores the variance in the human error that goes into projecting these players each and every year. So I know, Sean, that you manage a ton of teams. You kind of already talked about this a bit. You manage a ton of teams and leagues with all sorts of different stakes. You know, you mentioned that you're not necessarily going zero RB in every single league, but for folks who might be out there just pounding MFL 10s, would you advise that they stick with that strategy, or should they diversify more just to get that bigger portfolio?
Well, in MFL 10s, I'm probably going about 70-80% zero running back. I was lucky enough to own Melvin Gordon on most of my teams last year, and so they generally did pretty well despite 2016 not being as favorable for that. But I expect there to be a bounce back and sort of a balancing with ADP to where, you know, zero running back is very effective in that format. But the MFL 10s are great because there's a lot of interesting nuance to the strategy, and there are certainly running back heavy approaches that will work really well as well.
So can you then give us, I think that a lot of people would love this, even though it's May, we're still degenerates. Can you give us a few of your current zero running back targets, perhaps in an MFL 10? You know, you and I just did the MFL 10 of death. You went zero RB in that, had some really interesting picks that I liked. I was kind of pissed that some of those running backs ended up falling to you. Or, you know, just guys that you could foresee yourself drafting in August based on the zero RB approach.
Yeah, I mostly like to target players who either haven't broken out yet or are coming off of bad seasons, players who have this really wide range of outcomes and could end up with big workloads if the season falls the right way. And, you know, 2017 looks like it's setting up really well to have some of these late round picks, just like you mentioned, players who are dropping. If we just look at people who went after pick 80 in the MFL 10 of death that you just mentioned, you have guys like Derrick Henry, Paul Perkins, Kareem Hunt, CJ Prosise, Matt Forte, Rex Burkhead, who I actually think becomes a little bit more interesting now that the competition is there and his cost is gonna really fall again or already has fallen again. You have Joe Williams, Marlon Mack. You know, Jonathan Williams is a guy where, I mean, very little has to go right. I mean, it's a very specific thing, but if that specific thing happens, you know, then his upside is through the roof. And then even you have someone like Chris Thompson sitting there at the very end of most drafts, and he's not someone who's going to fall into that big workload, but he's someone who is going to score points. And so, you know, round 15 or later, you have a very cheap source of points for people who maybe, you know, miss out on somebody else or have taken some big risks early and they want a few points later that they can count on, even if those aren't huge points.
So let me ask you this too. Whenever you're pinpointing these running backs, a guy that I love just because I love old players who have depressed ADPs is Frank Gore, just because he's in line for a lot of touches. And to me, he'd at least give you that baseline, especially if you're going with a wide receiver heavy approach to start. He'd at least give you some sort of baseline at the running back position. So if you're going zero RB, are you looking maybe as your first running back, are you looking more for that floor rather than that ceiling? And then as the draft progresses, you're looking at that ceiling? Or are you strictly looking and telling yourself a story as to how some of these running backs could eventually take on a bigger workload and then become fantasy RB1s?
I'm more looking for the big upside. I found that if you take young players who have big production in the past, you know, whether it be, I mean, usually those are players who had big production in college, and you know, some of them were drafted early, some of them even maybe weren't drafted that early, but are coming in, they're going to have. One of the great things about 2017 is that you actually have access to guys even very late who are going to start the season with some touches. And so you're not going to be in a position where you're necessarily taking zeros. And if you can get players who are potentially going to have the receiving portion of the workload or part of that receiving portion and then would expand from that, then I think that's really the area to target. I don't really look for floor at any point until the very end. And so, you know, if there's a receiver like a Chris Thompson or maybe a Shane Vereen, someone like that at the end, you know, I would look to them. Otherwise, I'm trying to get four or five guys who could break out and score a lot. And I think that's a key too, especially in a format like NFL 10s, where, you know, your goal is to win. It's not to finish, you know, third or fourth or to not have an embarrassing score. I mean, you want to structure your lineups, your rosters, such that you have a lot of built-in points. And then if a certain thing breaks the right way, you win, as opposed to, you know, making sure you're not taking a bunch of zeros.
All right, Sean, I really appreciate you coming on and talking zero RB with me, man. For those of you who aren't following Sean on Twitter, you should do so now at @FF_contrarian. And you can find a lot of his work over on rotoviz.com, including the original zero RB article that we referenced on the show. And speaking of the show, don't forget to subscribe to it on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play so that you never miss another one. I'll talk to you all on Friday with this week's mailbag episode. Thanks for listening.